is John Udell. My guest today is Barry Ribbeck. He's Director of Systems Architecture and Infrastructure at Rice University. He's been involved for a long time in directory and identity infrastructures in higher education. And we got together to review how things have been coming along on those fronts. When we last met, you were at University of Texas. Now you're at Rice.
Mm-hmm.
When did that happen?
2 years ago. Same distance, same, just a different direction.
Okay. It's been a couple of years, I think, since we met at the Dartmouth workshop.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of discussion then about the rollouts of token-based identity.
Right.
What's happened in the last couple of years along those lines?
Token has taken on, actually, a kind of a more generic term. So passwords are considered tokens now as well.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. A token is basically anything that can be used to authenticate. I think this came out of the federal government. I could be wrong.
Huh.
So what has changed with regard to token-based authentication? Are you thinking on focusing specifically on PKI-type things?
Not necessarily. What actually got me thinking about this was that, so here in New Hampshire, we're one of the two states that's slated to be the pilot for the RealID program,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's this huge negative reaction. I just got to wondering how much of that is a function of people never really having had any experience in their lives with any kind of machine-readable credential.
I really take, I don't want to say offense, but I take issue with people thinking that they don't do this currently. My favorite and primary example, and I keep going back to it because it just works so well, is the ATM environment.
Right.
And if you go back to, I don't remember how long ago it was that ATM cards first came out, but it was kind of onerous. You know, you would get an ATM card from your bank,
yep.
And you could only use it at your bank. And then, you know, some very smart people got together and they worked out the details, and then they basically built a federation where you could go between banks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was two-factor authentication, and people had a PIN, they never changed a password, and everything worked well. And I think the reason that it worked so well was that people didn't think of it as single ID.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually an international single ID.
That's true.
And the difference, the reason that it's so well accepted is it's very focused in scope, and it has a limited liability.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a perfect model for the single ID or, you know, some type of single login credential or identity credential.
Yeah,
I don't know of anybody today that doesn't have a debit card.
That's a really good point. So at Rice, what do incoming freshmen nowadays receive by way of access tokens?
The difference between Rice and Health Science Center Houston is that Health Science Center Houston is a graduate level school only, no undergraduates, and all of the medical school students are still issued tokens during their orientation, and that's how they get to a lot of applications that are medical related.
Mm-hmm.
Clinical faculty are required by policy to use digital certificates for encrypting email that has patient and confidential and patient identifiable information. I think that may be by state law. I know it's at least by UT policy.
Mm-hmm.
Rice, on the other hand, is an undergraduate and graduate, you know, R1 institution, and we have no HIPAA concerns, requirements, et cetera.
Right.
So what we're looking at for the use of our two-factor authentication and certificate-based authentication is for access to administrative systems.
Okay.
Things that are in my domain that require a higher level of assurance for two different functions. We're building the pieces that would allow our admins to be given a token with a certificate on it that would allow them to log in as an administrator.
Okay.
So, you know, it gives us a heightened level of security, plus we don't have to worry about passwords living on machines somewhere that could be broken into, especially the Windows boxes. That's pretty common.
Mm-hmm.
Once they have a password file, then they're getting into everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right now, there aren't what you consider to be high-risk assets then very much involved in what the undergraduates are going to be working with, so that they, you know, passwords are okay for them?
This is, in many ways, a hard concept for a lot of people to grasp. Levels of assurance are a trust metric for the credential that was issued.
Mm-hmm.
They're not an access control issue at all. It's not access control. LOA is the credential that's presented to me. How well do I, or how strongly do I trust this in terms of the mechanisms that manage it, the mechanisms that distribute it and create it,
mm-hmm.
and all of the technical functions that deal with its transport, et cetera, if it's just a password.
Right.
Or anything else, for that matter,
right.
You know, cryptographic, whatever. So the only time that LOA is equivalent to an access control mechanism is when authentication equals authorization.
Mm-hmm.
If you can log in, you can get at the resource.
Mm-hmm.
While we tend to shy away from that because there are some obvious problems there, there are a couple of low LOA applications where it makes sense. When you have a just-in-time provisioning application, for instance, a portal, where you can go in and you can authenticate, and it will set up a little database of information about you, and it will allow you in immediately just by authentication if it hasn't seen you before.
Right.
Okay. So that's a pretty low bar type of application where authentication does equal authorization for first encounter, and then after the fact, it uses that information to display your preferences and you know your profile, whatever it is that personalizes your experience.
Mm-hmm.
Things above that level, we really try to force authentication to be different from authorization. Because if you follow the DoD Orange Book rules for authorization, the rule of least access says you only give people what they need to do to do their job,
mm-hmm.
and no more.
Mm-hmm.
And so the authorization aspects are not in that case strictly tied to the authentication process or the level of assurance. I'm really trying to drive people away from using LOA as a I get access to it because I have a stronger credential.
Right.
No, we let you authenticate to it and we trust that credential. And if we don't trust the credential, then you know we're not going to let you into anything.
Yes.
And especially these things of higher value. But the trust level has to be a little bit higher for things that we want to give people access to that has confidential and sensitive information. And the way to think about that is, okay, so a student comes into the institution, we give them, this is a bad example for us, but an email account, and we allow them to authenticate to the web-based mail system unencrypted.
Okay.
All right, so immediately that lowers the LOA for that credential. We probably wouldn't want to use that credential to allow them to go in and change their courses.
When you give them multiple credentials, then, how is that handled right now?
We don't issue students multiple credentials currently.
Okay.
And we have no plans to do that in the near future.
Okay.
But for staff, it's the same type of deal. We give them, we don't allow passwords to go unencrypted across the network. So the password credential for Rice is pretty well protected. But if we were to, say someone were to bring up an application and they were to, a web-based application that wasn't running SSL,
mm-hmm.
and they would link it into our CAS system, then the password could be sent across our network or across the Internet, potentially unencrypted.
Mm-hmm.
That act would lower the level of assurance for that credential.
Mm-hmm. If you knew about it.
If you knew about it.
What seemed interesting to me at that PKI workshop a couple of years ago was people from a couple of different universities delivering the experience to their student populations
mm-hmm.
of what we imagined, or some of us imagined, would be happening in general on the internet, multi-factor authentication and single sign-on. There were a couple of interesting aspects to that, I thought. One of them was, I forget whose presentation it was, that sort of went through what the, if you will, the ceremony was for mm-hmm. giving the token, the physical token to someone.
Right.
And how that, in a way, sort of from a social perspective, gave people a sense of, you know, this is,
yes.
you know, this is, there's a ceremony around this. This is it's not just this abstract magic word that,
right.
you know, you remember and can share with your friends. It's this physical token that's really quite meaningful. And
she was a faculty member there in...
Was it, in fact, a Dartmouth person?
Yes. This was a lady that kind of got roped into this at Dartmouth, and it was pretty cool. She did a study on...
Yeah, this is the woman that did the study on the password sharing behavior?
Yes, it's a user behavior study.
Yeah.
Denise Anthony.
Yeah.
They did the study to try and figure out why it was that the tokens were considered not as shareable as passwords.
Yeah.
And one of it was the physical access. It's kind of like your car keys, you know?
Yeah.
You might write something down on a piece of paper and hand it to somebody because you never expect to get it back. But if you hand them your car keys, you expect to get it back, and so you
exactly.
you psychologically attach a higher value to it.
Exactly.
And going through the ceremony, I'm not sure how much weight that puts, you know, personally, but it could test out to be a significant difference. I really just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That kind of process was happening more at UT than it...
It did happen at UT, but they do it only for the PKI tokens. The user passwords, they're distributed to, there's no ceremony involved other than the orientation piece, so it's in their orientation package.
Okay.
So, you know, they actually physically hand them out to them during orientation along with a lot of other stuff, so it's nothing uniquely different about that than any other information they get.
Okay.
For their login credential, for their PKI token, you know, they go through this. It is a ceremony. You know, they show up and they have to show two forms of government issued pictured ID.
Yeah.
They do it during orientation. If they have to renew it where they've lost it or can't remember how to log in or whatever, they have to go through the same process all over again.
Yeah. And it's been effective, right?
It has been very effective.
In the world of academic computing, there's this whole ecosystem of federated identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very different from what exists and is emerging in the commercial world.
How so?
For example, Shibboleth is something that has been very common and popular
mm-hmm.
in the academic world, but
mm-hmm.
only there, pretty much, as far as I can tell.
Not so? Well, in the academic world, including things that academia touches, not necessarily commercial entities that have adopted Shibboleth that are not academic but sell heavily to academic areas, yes.
Yeah. So that's an example, and also the kinds of, is it HEBCA, is that right?
The Higher Bridge Certificate Authority?
The Bridge C thing, yeah. There's this base of experience in terms of federating across academic institutions that's not yet in the commercial world to the same degree, just because you guys have apparently been doing it for a while.
I'm not sure. Well, it depends. So I think you're correct in that it's not prolific, you know. It's not, you don't see Shibboleth being deployed in the commercial world like you see Shibboleth being deployed. I mean, obviously Shibboleth has there are places where it's just taken off across the country
mm-hmm.
Through all of academia, like the Swiss and the Spanish and the UK, where, you know, they're done. They have their federations up and running, and they're working very well, thank you very much.
Hmm.
And, you know, is the Australians and some of the Asian Rim countries are in the midst of deploying, and even though it started out here, it's had some slow uptake because it's not like, it's more useful within a system of higher education. It's more of a scaling issue for the U.S. You know, so there's a couple things that play into that. So if the funding agencies that fund research for the R1 institutions, it puts pressure on them to do more collaborative work, then there will be more need for Shibboleth-like federated access.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so, and that's happening. We
okay.
already see that happening.
Okay.
So from the grid community and whatever else, these applications that are collaborative issues or collaborative works across institutions where funding is involved, obviously that's going to drive some, that's going to be a driver. For HEBCA, it was an attempt and still is. It's still, it's dormant.
Oh, is it?
It's waiting for deployments that have actually occurred within the commercial entities. So there are some centers of activity regarding PKI deployments, which you heard one at Dartmouth, and that was the Johnson & Johnson Safe Bridge.
Yeah.
There's also the Aerospace Bridge. And, you know, these are collaborative works between commercial entities that need to interact with the federal government, with each other, within a certain space. So the aerospace industry has a huge, you know, group, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, Airbus, all of these, you know, huge airplane and aeronautical space, whatever, vehicle manufacturers that need to interact with one another because the federal government is requiring them to take some of these large projects and work together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the DOD is requiring a level 3 two-factor certificate-based authentication. That's occurring.
Okay. So in realms that are not necessarily visible to a lot of people, say aerospace or say pharmaceuticals,
right.
there is in fact evolving and emerging this government-mandated collaboration, which is being woven together by PKI bridges.
Right.
Right.
But, and it's really surpassed what we wanted to do in higher education. It may not have occurred in higher education because there wasn't big drivers for it. I think it still makes sense. It's obviously the way to go if you're going to do that type of work, collaborative work. Those are things that just make it easy, and it's the only way to do it. I think it was a little ahead of its time because there weren't collaborative processes and drivers to to make that work prevalent. The pharmaceutical industry has really taken off with it. It's really amazing, especially within Johnson & Johnson, because they've adopted all of this in-house workflow around it. It makes it just seamless. It's just really, really cool. Now, on that same note, the federal government is still deploying. I mean, they're hot and heavy into it. The HSPD 12 requirements, I think the deadline for that was in October of last year. They did a six-month extension, and now we get hit from it. In December, I get this panic phone call from our comptroller saying, we get this thing from the Department of Defense and the Naval Research, and we can't get onto their grant application website without this thing called a digital certificate. I was going, hallelujah. You know, it finally happened. The federal government finally came through. So we had to go and deploy certificates, and we did so on tokens for convenience factor, you know, so people could go between machines without having to distribute the certificates everywhere.
You cross-certified as an institution with a branch of the government in order to...
No, we did not. And the reason that we didn't was because, A, we don't have a PKI that can hear, that can measure up to the standards required by the federal government.
Okay.
And number two, the numbers of certificates required on campus was less than the breakpoint for purchasing a PKI engagement with a commercial vendor that is cross-certified.
Okay,
so we had 20 people on campus that needed this access.
Okay.
So we just went out and bought them certs.
Yeah, yeah.
Put them on tokens and gave them to them and said, this is how you use them. However, University of Texas System, Claire Goldsmith and crew, are working very hard to cross-certify their VeriSign commercial entity certificate authority certificates with the federal government, and they expect that work to be done in the next couple months. When that's complete, then they will be able to use their VeriSign-issued certs under the University of Texas System certificate authority to access federal government sites. That's the dream of the bridge, is that now I don't have to go and get something special from you, just like federations. I don't have to go and get yet another credential from somebody else to get access to something. You know, these people have validated who I am strongly enough. They have a high enough level of assurance, and the process and everything else is secure enough to where they can trust the credential that's being offered.
It sounds like things are moving along. It's, I guess, what was it, probably 2 years ago that you and I met at Dartmouth?
At least, no, it's been more than that.
Might have been three.
Yeah.
The message then was, yeah, you know, it's slow, but it's coming along, and it kind of still is the message now, but nonetheless, it's coming along. And in places that, again, are not really very visible to most people, so it's hard to sort of get a sense of what's happening, but that's, you know, that's why it's interesting to talk to folks like you that do have more visibility into that world than most of us, because at least you can assure us, yeah, you know, you may not see it happening, but it is happening.
I think that for the most part, that's the most important thing for continuing the deployment, in that it's invisible to the end user.
Yeah. yeah, yeah.
If, as long as everything is more secure, doesn't require a hurdle higher than I'm having to jump currently, people are comfortable moving forward. If you put this big barrier up in front of people, then, you know, they tend to go around it every time. In terms of the deployment pieces for PKI, I do see a lot of traction. I do see a lot of things happening, but the common phrase for PKI is PKI is 6 months away from, you know, complete deployment for the last 16 years.
Right.
You know, it's been that way, and I think that people need to come to grips with there's not going to be this big aha, this big magic bullet.
Yeah.
Super app that's going to say, okay, everybody run out and go get a PKI token because it's the best thing since sliced bread and long neck beer.
Yeah.
It's just, that's not the way that this is going to happen. It's going to be the same way that ATM cards were deployed. It's going to be this slow deployment, and before long everybody will have one, and they'll know what to do with it, and they'll use it just like they do anything else. I always hate to use the security hammer because you end up being Chicken Little. You know, oh, if you don't do this, then security is going to be the problem, and you know, you're going to, all this stuff is going to be exposed, and the institution is going to fail because you didn't do X, Y, or Z. You know, the Chicken Little thing just never works. You can only claim that for so long, and then people stop believing you. There are a number of institutions that are mostly healthcare, higher education institutions, that are deploying PKI now. So University of Wisconsin has a deployment in progress, and I'm going up in 2 weeks to go talk to University of Chicago Medical School. They're wanting to look at PKI as a two-factor authentication product for securing their clinical apps.
Right.
And they're, you know, now that there are some institutions that have been doing this for a while, it's not, oh, we're going to be on the bleeding edge. You know, the technology is, asymmetric cryptography is a well understood, well deployed, and well-defined set of standards that have been out for a long time.
It's perhaps also the case that if they look at doing it today as opposed to 2 or 3 years ago, there's a higher likelihood that they're going to get some additional benefits from it, like, for example, the ability to federate with the government around grant applications, right? That would be, you know, that would be, if you will, a freebie that would fall out of
if they do it right. So the one of the challenges here is getting people to understand that this could be a phased deployment. So if you look at the differences between the way that some higher education institutions have approached PKI, you have the whole gamut. So you have MIT on one end. MIT's credentials that they issue, certificates, are no higher LOA than their passwords. None whatsoever.
Right.
They only use it for authentication to websites,
right.
Period. That's it. Nothing more. They don't support or encourage S/MIME. They don't encourage or support, you know, using it for document signing. So they have no escrow, they have no infrastructure to support any of the other things. And they've done this for over 10 years, and it works quite well with them.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit that they get out of this is that they no longer have to worry about their credential being compromised due to technical issues in the deployment. So you can sit there and sniff the wire and watch everything that goes across it. You're still never going to get their private key. You have to go to the machine because they allow soft cryptographic stores. They also allow hard tokens, or they're starting to. Virginia did something a little different. They issue out, just like Dartmouth, they use the rainbow keys, and they have a differential LOA, so they have a lower assurance level certificate and a higher assurance level certificate that they issue for other applications where you actually have to come in and vet, and they have one that they will issue you based on you can log in to their mail server or whatever.
Right.
I think Dartmouth has a 2 LOA, just like the UT system, where, you know, whatever your password is a different, explicitly different from the credential that's issued on a USB token PKI credential.
So that's how it gets to be multi-factor.
Well, it's multi-factor, but then the use cases become very different. So at UT, the initial driver for PKI was document signing, and no document signing is done.
right.
But there's a lot of S/MIME, and there's a lot of authentication. So depending upon, you know, these phased deployments have to occur based on, okay, we get the infrastructure up and we attack the initial problem. Then we can look at leveraging. I like leveraging technology. I don't like the one-trick ponies. There are places for one-trick ponies and one-drum operations, but IT really functions better when it can leverage its infrastructure.
Right.
You know, you don't want to build the rail system that only can haul cattle cars.
To circle back around, the point is that these PKI deployments are becoming more leverageable as these federations are beginning to mature and stabilize.
Well, I don't want to mince the terms. The federations are generally around the shibboleth type infrastructures, and while you can use PKI in the federations, the bridges are generally the term that you associate with linking certificate authorities.
Okay.
Okay, and the federations are more of the policy agreements between institutions that will allow them to share whatever credential that they offer.
So you wouldn't consider a network of interlinked CAs to be a federation?
No.
You would just use a different word for that?
It'll be a bridge.
Oh, okay. Or, well, really a collection of bridges, right?
Or it could be, correct.
Okay.
And it's just like anything else. You know, it's just this, it's almost a layer of abstraction that allows lots of scale things to work better together.
This is fascinating. I appreciate you chatting with me about this. Do they still do that every summer up at Dartmouth?
It is every summer, but it's not at Dartmouth anymore. It's back in Snowmass. It generally had followed the seminars on academic computing, which has been held every year for 50 years or whatever in Snowmass, Colorado in August.
Okay.
And EDUCAUSE hosts it. And you'd be most welcome to attend.
It'd be a little harder than just driving up the road like it was for Dartmouth.
But it is a little harder. It's a real pain in the butt to get to, but it's beautiful there in the summertime. And all the players are generally there, and we try to get together, all the useful folks. The PKI world is, I think, progressing at its own pace, and it's a good pace. There's no more this, you know, rush to go out and get it thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's people are deploying where they need to deploy, and it's the way of the world, you know.
Thanks very much, Barry. This was really helpful for me and a lot of fun.
All right, take care.
Take care.